This is tape two with Dr. LaFawn, side A, on his interview of 27 February 2000 at his home in San Diego.
On the skate, we ran under the ice, measuring the depth of the water and the thickness of the ice above. Went to the North Pole, and the captain steered a circular course, 2 mile radius, to go around the Earth in about 45 minutes. That's the fastest most anybody has gone around the world. We also found there was no Polynya at the North Pole, but we found one a few miles from the North Pole, surfaced. Captain also contacted I Station Alpha, said we were coming. They said they had a Polynya near the station that he could surface in, that they would run an outboard motor to make a sound so he could home in on it. But most of the people on the submarine were tired, and so they stayed in this Polynya overnight. But the poor Alpha person, who was the director, ran his motor all night long. It was useful in detecting the particular opening in the ice. We surfaced there. Some of us went over to the station. We gave them some ice cream, brought them aboard for a meal. Ice was closing in on us, and we had to get out. We surfaced a total of 7 different places. Most places we could get out on the ice, sample the Polynya, sample the ice,
limit. How far did you surface from the North Pole? You said you surfaced in a Polynya near the North Pole.
It's a matter of miles. Mm-hmm. Since I was a chief scientist, I couldn't have a bunk. All the rest had these layered bunks. they quartered me in the wardroom with a drop-down bed. The only trouble with this was that the wardroom was occupied till at least midnight, and then they opened it up again at 6 o'clock in the morning. So it didn't allow me much sleep. We had very good food on board, cooked in a very small galley. One time I had a fire drill. Without notice, the submarine was filled with smoke. The steward in the wardroom gave me a gas mask, helped me put it on. But it was scary because you couldn't hardly breathe. But eventually it cleared up. All was well.
Which ocean did you exit from?
This is where we came out, more or less.
The same place you went in, you came out, the North Atlantic?
Yes. Went in the North Atlantic, came out the North Atlantic.
How was Admiral Calvert to work with, or Commander Calvert at the time?
Well, he was a very capable person, very well read. But he was after publicity. And he directed one officer to go through every magazine in the wardroom, write to the editor and say we have his magazine on board the skate at the North Pole. And I saw two of those letters published in magazines.
Interesting.
He shot a torpedo in the ice. As my recollection, it didn't explode. It slid up on the ice. We came out. We got a lot of depth data. One of NEL personnel constructed a topographic chart of the Arctic based on our data. What's his name?
Bobby.
No. Mary Revelle girl. Gun collector.
It begins with S. Shumway.
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 What's his first name? George. George Shumway.
Tell me, were there any personnel problems, physical problems, mental problems of people being cooped up in a submarine for so long under the ice?
We had a new navigational system. It's called the inertia guidance system. Inertia guidance system. It was being tried out, I think, for the first time. Instead of units of 10, it's units of 8. It seemed to work quite well. But the operator didn't like living on submarines. I don't know whether he was scared or just what, but it wasn't operating full capacity. So we were, the captain was afraid that he might do some damage. So he left him in his stateroom with supervision. When we came out, we headed for Bergen, Norway. The ambassador to Norway, U.S. ambassador to Norway, was a woman. She came to Bergen to, and they said we'll be there at noon. And they calculated backwards, so we just touched the dock exactly at noon. We had to go up a long fjord. Wasn't much of a ceremony, but I met some Norwegians that I have heard of. Then the next stop was Oslo. There we did have a party. We wanted to stop in Oslo. I met a man by the name of Odd Dahl, O-D-D-D-A-H-L, who had made a current meter for the Maud. Sverda brought it over to Scripps when he came, and I mounted it on the Scripps pier.
What was the name of the meter?
It didn't have a name, it's just a, I call it an Odd Dahl meter.
What did it measure? It
measured the current speed and direction.
On the Maud?
On the Maud, right. It's so okay for places like the Arctic where the water's slow motion, but near the breaking waves at the end of Scripps Pier. During a storm, it's kind of hard on the meter. More than one night I've gotten up when I lived there, lived on the campus, and go out on the pier in a storm, pull the meter up out of the water, keep it from becoming damaged. Anyway, we toasted everybody, including their relatives, with, what would they call it? What do they call this? What do they call the drink?
Aquavit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aquavit. We wanted to stop in Denmark, Copenhagen. They would have nothing with an atomic submarine. We did stop in Belgium, having a world fair. '68. That's where I got off of the sub and flew home. The other person from the lab was Rex Rowry, R-E-X-R-O-W-R-A-Y, I guess. It's in there.
It's in here.
Well, I think I'm through.
You have Walt Whitman with you?
Yes. And Walt Whitman.
Where is Walt from?
He's from the Hydrographic Office.
In Washington?
Yes. He took the ice data, the thickness of the ice. You get back to the Hydrographic Office.
Then that was your last cruise to the Arctic?
Last one.
Okay.
Flew up to Prudhoe Bay one time, but...
What was that for?
In the connection with a meeting in Fairbanks. The Alaskan Science Congress. About 1970.
You want to know what year it was? Let me go back to the pole. You had drinks at the North Pole too. The captain declared they...
Yeah. Broke out whiskey. It was all a drink.
Medical.
Yeah.
Medical.
Cold outside.
Medical emergency.
Yeah. It was,
correct.
Cold outside.
Yes. And that was in the summer.
Yeah.
Did you go on the next cruise with the skate too?
No. It broke through the ice and so on. Didn't do that.
I see. So he only surfaced in Polynyas on this cruise?
Yes.
He didn't break through the ice?
Correct.
I see. Now, were you involved afterwards in managing any of the polar research programs that others took to the Arctic?
No.
I see. What was your job after that?
I was more interested in the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I headed the Naga Expedition in the South China Sea and the Gulf of Thailand. International Indian Ocean Expedition. Catherine was with me. We took in the Arabian Sea, Bay of Bengal, Andaman Sea, that was a big deal.
Which ship were you on the International Indian Expedition?
The Anton Bruhn.
The which?
Anton Bruhn. A-N-T-O-N.
Anton?
B-R-U-U-N.
B-R-U-U-N. Indian ship?
No. It was President Truman's presidential yacht.
The Williamsburg.
It was called the Williamsburg at that time. They took and modified it with winches.
I see. And that was run by NEL?
No. The Anton Bruhn, that was of Woods Hole.
Woods Hole?
No, it's not Woods. Well, I guess they got the money from the National Science Foundation.
Mm-hmm. You were at NEL during that time, though?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Took leave of absence all the time.
To do those. Okay. What took you to India? How did you get there?
That's another session.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in brief.
Well, Henry Menard, who was in my group, we kept changing the name of it, the group, came into my office and said, here's a brochure by the State Department. Little small thing. And I looked at it, brought it home to Catherine. Said, you want to go to India or you want to go to New Zealand? I said, well, you've been to New Zealand. We don't know anything about India. So let's go to India. So I applied. I think I was the only person in the world. Applied for this Fulbright grant. And you're it. And we got cold feet. said, well, I would have to have a ship. I'd have to not give lectures, coursework, and do research. So, yes, 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 come. So we packed up two boys and how many pieces of equipment?
20, I think there were 23 pieces of luggage. 23, 24 pieces of luggage.
Which year was this?
52.
52.
Mm-hmm. And we...
Everybody said don't do it.
We took a plane to New York. The Queen Mary to London. England. And we're going to take American Express is going to provide us with transportation beyond London to India. Well, they hadn't heard of us in London. Said, okay, we want to go home. We had enough of this silly stuff. Didn't want to go in the first place. So they said, if you go down and find yourself transportation, we'll pay for it. So we walked up and down the streets. And finally got passage on P&O. Himalaya?
The Himalaya.
London to Bombay. Got to Bombay, give us a handful of money. They were ready for us there. Because they made such a stink about leaving us in London. And we checked in a hotel, made bookings for a train across India. So where we were going with Voltaire was at Andhra University.
This was in Goa?
No, it's on the opposite side, on the Bay of Bengal. And so, well, we got our tickets for the train, immediately got dysentery. Weren't used to their food. Well, getting the stuff into India with some 23 boxes, had BGs, dancing bottles, nets and samplers, bumps. Hydro photometer and so on, all boxed up. Then what are these? I said, they're oceanographic instruments. And how much are they worth? I said, oh, a couple $1,000. I said, well, you can't. You have to pay 37% import duty. Here's the book. See here? 37%. I said, I don't have the money and I wouldn't pay it if I had. So anyway, they locked it up. So we had to communicate with Delhi and finally got it sprung. With the stipulation that we had it exported within a year. So we got on the train. Very dirty soot, coal, burning engine. Why don't you tell this, dear?
Okay, well, I'll be happy to. We got on the train again.
This is a very unique opportunity to get an interview with Catherine LaFawn, Dr. LaFawn's wife. Who was a very active participant in his decisions to become a scientist, be an oceanographer, and was involved in his research throughout his career. Certainly more than a supportive mode, as most wives are. So I'm taking this opportunity to have her present some of the issues that she faced while she was when she met Dr. LaFawn and the rest of their life together.
Okay, well, I had graduated from Bishop School here in La Jolla, and then I spent 2 years in Berlin, Germany, and I had just come home and was casting around for something to do. And I met, I think it was Dr. Pierce at that date, who was head of the chemistry department at State College. And he suggested that I audit some of his classes there in the chemistry department, which I did. And I think there were one or two women in the chemistry department there beside myself. But one day, this Jean comes up to me, "Miss Gehring, will you please help me with my German?" He was taking German, of course. German to me by then was my second language. And so I helped him with German, and that was how we met, doing German together. And then in 1932 he graduated, and I left the school. But this was a depression, and he tried so hard to get a job and tried many, many different places many times, was unsuccessful. And in the meantime, I had been volunteering at the poultry laboratory at the zoo and also with Dr. Schroeder at the zoo hospital. And in trying to improve my microscopic work, I went out to Scripps and talked with one of the women who was a pro at making these paraffin sections. And while we were there, we walked across the campus and ran into Dr. Moberg. And she introduced me and said that I had come from the zoo, but I was looking for something. He was looking, "If you have chemistry, I have a job for you. These salinity samples have come up from my graduate student, and that they need titration. I will pay you $100 a month." Well, in those days, that was a lot of money, and I couldn't afford not to accept. So I gave up the zoo work, which I loved, and went out to Scripps. And I started out doing the salinities for Dick Fleming, and then it gradually branched out into other things. I'd only been at Scripps for maybe a short month when Dr. Moberg came in and said, "Will you make a list for provisions? The ship is going out for 10 days on a cruise, and what provisions shall we provide? There's no refrigeration, but do your best." So I made lists of provisions to buy and the menus and so on. And then and different other times during these 3 years I was there, I was the first woman who ever went out on a cruise with the old Scripps ships. But they had no overnight accommodation for a woman, of course, and so it was only a day cruise. But then I would come home with all the samples that we collected. The other boys had said, "I've worked all day and go to sleep, but I have to stay at Scripps and run those samples." But I worked there for quite a while, and I persuaded Jean to come out and talk with Dr. Moberg and see if there was something at Scripps that he could do. And there was nothing right then that he could do, but Jean was so tired of trying to find a job, he said, "I'll be happy to. Be happy to come and work just for nothing, because it's such a nice environment. I would learn something here." So he did, and that was the beginning of his work there at Scripps. Eventually they would find a little bit of money, and then a little more and a little more. And that worked out very nicely. And then there was nepotism, though, was in force. The members of the same family could not work in the same department. So that let me, as long as we were working, and of course $100 a month meant a great deal. And when Jean was still not secure in his job that I was afraid to give up my job. But in the meantime, he had decided to continue his education to go on up to Berkeley, and Dr. Vaughn had encouraged him to do it. And so I took a leave of absence, and we announced our marriage.
When did you get married?
In 1935.
And you worked together without announcing it for
how
long?
Oh, yeah. We lived separately there for a year. I had a cottage down below on the campus, and Jean was up in what was called the doghouse up at the top of the hill. It had been a laboratory storage kennel for the dogs at the one of the clinics in La Jolla. But that was the doghouse. He lived up there, and I lived down at Scripps. But then when he went up to Berkeley, I went up with him. It was theoretically a leave of absence.
And then you announced your marriage.
That's when we announced our marriage.
Did your family know you were married?
Well, they had a pretty good idea, but
oh,
they
but
had
you didn't
no,
tell them.
They, no, I didn't tell them.
Did you tell your family, Jean? No.
I sent everybody announcements. My family and his family, though, they all got it announcements at the same time. We went up to Berkeley, and I went on WPA there. And an interesting thing that happened while I was there, WPA got a call for a librarian from the Shell Oil Company. And they called me in and said, here, they need a librarian. You would be just fine. Go down and apply for the job. And I did, and I had an interview with this man, and I filled out the application. And he looked at the application, and he said, oh, you're married. And I said, yes. And he said, well, all our girls are single, at least we think they are. And we don't hire any married women. I'm very sorry. So that let me out of that job. There's a reason for some of these things that happen in life. But I finished up my work up there I was in the botany department at Berkeley. Gene finished his schoolwork there, his year of work, and came back down to Scripps. And I gave up and came down too. And when he came back to Scripps, I was without a job.
Roger, hey, where was botany at Cal? Which
botany
building?
Was on the campus.
Life Sciences building?
Yes.
I worked in the Life Sciences building.
I worked for Davis.
I worked for Herb Evans.
Uh-huh.
He was an anatomist.
And then, yeah, well, I worked for Dr. Davis there in the botany department. But then I gave up and came back to Scripps, and Roger tried his best to get around this nepotism business, and he hired me. But he paid me out of his own thing. Yes, Robert?
Would you like to take a break and eat something, or
would you like some lunch?
That'd be great.
Okay, sure. You can pick up something. I'll say 20 minutes, whatever.
Okay. Work something.
That's when you said Roger, you mean Roger Revelle?
Right, I meant Roger Revelle. But he paid me out of his own pocket.
And now, this is in 1930...
36, 37, we were in Berkeley, came down about 1937 and through there. And then I was without a job. But through Dr. Schroeder met ophthalmologist in San Diego who wanted some German technology, medical books translated. So for quite a long time, I did some German translation there for him. Dr. Kilgore, I believe his name was. And I loved that. I enjoyed it. I came, my father was a doctor and mother was a nurse, and I was raised in a medical atmosphere, and so I had a good vocabulary, both in German and English, and it was very easy for me, and I enjoyed it greatly. But then that job ended, and I had the two boys, and I stayed home raising boys, but I also always had worked with Gene. He'd bring some of his work home and we'd do it together and work. So we've always, throughout our whole marriage, have worked together. And then Gene came home. We moved over into this house from Scripps when he came back from Bikini. And then we moved from Scripps out here because he was no longer employed by Scripps. So we came here and bought this house, and we were here, and Gene brought this notice home. Would you like to go to New Zealand or to India? Well, of course, I like to travel too, and that was an idea that would be something new. So after much discussion and trying hard to decide what would be best and so on, we packed up everything from the house and made all these lists. Gene borrowed equipment from the lab, and we set off with 24, 25 boxes of luggage, suitcases and everything, you name it, and went off to India. And that was really very good. We were the only Americans they had known. The location, I should say, it's about 400 miles south of Calcutta and about north of Madras. We were just out in the middle. But it was a large university. The setup is very much like Berkeley, with a central university and many sister universities in the environs. But we were at the central university there.
What was the name of it?
Andhra, A-N-D-H-R-A, Andhra University. And people had no idea what to expect with the... There had been many British people who had lived through there. And they knew the British, but they'd never had the Americans. And they didn't know much about America either. One of the first things when we lived there, one of the students came up to me. We had a big porch. And I sat on the front porch with a Sears and Roebuck catalog and explained all about the United States in one easy lesson. And he came up to me, what was the first thing that you noticed about women, or about India? What made the biggest impression to you on India? And I said, women carrying water in their heads. Well, how else do you get water? I mean, he just was so sincere about how else do you get your water? And I said, well, our water is piped in. And then another boy on the campus came over one day, very distraught. He had just gotten a grant to come to the United States, but he was a little bit afraid to come. And I was talking to him about it, and he said, well, tell me, what are his chances of crossing the United States in a train without an Indian attack? I mean, they knew that much about the United States.
They saw a cowboy movie.
Yeah. They knew that much. And of course in 1952 they were just piping water up and down so many of the little outlying settlements. They all had to carry their water. But we had one of the only flush toilets on the campus. We had no refrigeration, but we did have water. We kept the water in the bathroom, because sometimes the water was shut off too. So we always had a bathtub full of water. But we did have running water. They built me a kitchen. They piped water into one room to make a kitchen. And they built me a stove, very much like the stoves that you see in the national parks. You know, a charcoal burning stove. We had charcoal. And for our first Christmas, I had a reception, and I made it known. I had a wonderful bearer. He was really very good. And they had a good grapevine. And I made it be known that there would be no meat. Everything would be vegetarian. And all I served, I made umpteen chocolate brownies. And we had tea. and I bought a lot of, they call them biscuits, but they're cookies. But everything was sold not in packages, but in tin boxes because of the insects that get into everything. So I had the chocolate brownies and the cookies and the tea. And Thomas served everything. The women all congregated in the dining room. The men all congregated out in the front porch. They ate cashew nuts, which grew on the campus. They're very common, but I had cashew nuts. And they ate the cashew nuts. They ate the biscuits. They drank the tea. But the sweeper took all the chocolate brownies home. Mm-hmm. It was a Hindu area, a Brahmin, which is the highest caste among the Hindus. And so none of them would ever touch any meat or fish, or even all degrees of vegetarianism. Some will eat onions, some will not, some will use eggs, and some will not. But we tried, and any time they ever had anything to eat with us, we always had their vegetarian type of food. So, but it worked out very nicely. Gene got his boys together. He had a few classes that he did have, in spite of the fact he didn't want classes. But he had classes, and the Navy would loan him Navy minesweepers. And I think he made 15, 17 cruises out in the Bay of Bengal on these minesweepers with the borrowed equipment that he had brought, and some he had made there in Vizag, which is the main city, and Voltaire is a suburb of that. And I remember I was with them when they did that. They dug a hole in the ground to make a bottom weight. They dug the hole in the bottom in the ground and poured in the lead, made us put a pipe in it, and that made the that was their sinker that made the weight for that. But then Gene took this equipment out with him, and sometimes a time or two, not too often, but a time or two, they would lose equipment overboard. Well, now he had signed that he would, with his life, he would export all that equipment. So the case is still pending. One Christmas, my mother one time wanted to send me something, and the only thing she could think of was to send me a care package, which she did. And the care package came on through, and I received it. But I wasn't in a desperate state for food, you see. So I gave all my food away, but I was supposed to have paid duty on this and done all this and that and the other. So that case is still pending, too.
Tell me, you said you worked with Gene all his life in his work. Did you get involved with any of the Arctic work, the data?
I did the data when we came back from India. I worked with him in the Indian Ocean Expedition. Mm-hmm. I was, I call it chief cook and bottle washer. But I took all the records. Gene and I were up for every station. He set the records for the other boys who did the chemistry and the oceanographic work, six on, six off, which is the way most of them do. But Gene and I were up for every station. And I took all the records at 8 o'clock. We did so-and-so, so-and-so, and So I did all those records, and then when we came back and were working in Paris, I did all the computations from those data.
In Paris?
Yeah.
France?
Was there with UNESCO for 6 months.
Yes.
And I was, there.
Director of the Office of Oceanography.
Deputy Director of the Office of Oceanography for UNESCO.
And he was there and I was with him. And I did all the work on that data at that time.
The Indian data?
The work that we had taken out in the Indian Ocean.
Do you you did some classified research, I'm sure, up in the Arctic on the skate. Is that not correct?
Well, it's hard to tell. It's classified, and somebody says it's unclassified.
Well, all your bikini stuff was... That motivated me mostly to get Gene to write his biography.
Mm-hmm.
So that I wanted our boys, all during the war years, everything was classified. I wanted our boys to know what he was doing during all those years and all those trips that he took. And so years later, when it was all declassified, that's when he wrote all this down, you see.
Yes. The rule is 40 years in general. Sometimes things can be classified longer.
Yeah.
Not usually technical stuff, but personnel stuff to protect spies.
Yeah.
Like
well, it was... but then later, many years later when we came back, it was in the late 60s, I'd say, in the mid-60s, when I came back and joined him over at the laboratory. He was still working at NEL, and I came on board then. And that was kind of an exception for a wife to be working at
you,
the Navy.
You went to work for NEL?
I went to work for NEL, too.
For the same office?
For the same office we worked together.
The Arctic Project office?
Well, it wasn't Arctic work as much as sending the Indian work and some of the work that he was doing off the coast here.
Mm-hmm.
All that work that he would bring.
You didn't get involved in any of the Arctic cruise thing?
No, I didn't get in. I wasn't involved in any of the...
Did you have clearance there?
I had at the lab, but not during the Arctic when he was there. But when I went to the lab, I had clearance.
Yeah, she was secret.
And we went to Thailand. We went to Thailand together. We went over to Vietnam when the war was about to wind down. Both of us were at the lab, and we were asked to go over to Nha Trang, to the Oceanographic Institute there, and see what they needed to restock their institute and start up their work. And so both of us went over to Nha Trang, went over to Vietnam, and had some experiences over there, I would say. But we enjoyed it. The war was still going on. I mean, they were shooting at the house where we were living. There were oil tanks not too far away, and they were shooting at those. And they were shooting at the airplanes as we were flying in this little Navy plane and so on. So we had quite some experiences over there. But went through the institute, and the thing that impressed me mostly, there at the institute, they had this beautiful library. It had been French, Indochina, and the French had used, and they had this a very, very beautiful library of these hand-painted, hand-drawn, all the specimens. Every fish that had ever been caught in that part of the world was there. But it was a very exceptional library. They had that, and then they had a big laboratories of pickled fish.
Mm-hmm.
They kept them dark so they wouldn't fade, but there were thousands of glass jars of pickled fish in there. But it was really a very interesting place. The director is still a very good friend of ours. He was independently wealthy because his wife had a pig farm. So he could go abroad and buy books and so on for his institute, because he had money to do it, to see that he was moonlighting, so to speak, that way. But then after the war, he had quite some experiences, and I can say this much about it. We got a letter one time asking us to sponsor him. And before we could answer it, Saigon fell. And then I called the Red Cross, what can we do? And they said, you do more harm for him than not, just leave it alone. So we did. And quite some time later, we got a letter that had been mailed from by some priest in Canada. Came down to us. Somehow he smuggled a letter out and gotten a letter to us. But what had happened when it fell, he and his wife and four little children, bing, 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 little step, that walked down to the dock and got on the boat with the clothes on their back, and that was it. And they got out to sea, and I think they were shot at and had all kinds of problems. But eventually, a U.S. Navy boat was out there and picked him up and brought him in. And we heard from him from a place in Pennsylvania. And then that was when we kept up again with him. And he was trying to work on his specialty was marine worms.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us are oceanographic here people who had known of him tried to get him jobs. And he finally got a job here and he got a job there somehow. But he was a real interesting experience. And some of the men that she worked with, now he was in Thailand for 3 months there over Christmas time, working with the Thai Navy. And he was, some of the men he worked with then were lost at the, in the, for instance, one man, I think his name was High. It was Gene worked in, was fond of him. I mean, they worked together. Well, anyway, he was out on a cruise and they boarded the ship and I think they molested his wife and he went to respect her and they threw him overboard.
Oh.
You know, things like, so that there were lots of things happened there. But that was some of the work that we have been doing together. So
just talk into the mic.
Okay, I'll talk into the mic here.
I should have got Gene's picture, so we're gonna have to sit him back down.
Okay. Well, I'll get up and you can sit back then.
Well, you've had a wonderful life together.
We have had
very close.
We've had a very close, very, 65 years this fall.
65 years.
In 65 years.
You're going to stay with it.
I'm going to stay with it. I get all these letters from these matrimonial companies and brochures, you know, would you like to meet somebody? I call them up and I say, you might as well take my name off your list.
I've got one more question for you, Gene, if you'd sit down over there. And
let me get up.
And I'll get your picture, too.
Well,
and, this is my project for the pictures.
I'll get up. Did you want one or both?
Well, why don't we get both of you?
Okay.
Well, let me get the one of Gene, and you then you sit down again, and I'll get you both. How's that?
You get Gene.
I've got a question for you, too, to answer. You said that you got into oceanography almost like by a fluke. You've had a long career in it. Have you anything to comment on it? Any regrets what you could have done in your career, or have things turned out better than you'd ever expected?
Well, we had a lot of decisions, but. I think we made the right ones each time. So I really have no regrets. I don't know what I would have done differently to come out as well as it did.
Why don't you snuggle up with this guy and I'll get your picture.
Oh.
We can call it a day.
Oh, okay. Well, when Gene was offered a job in Washington, D.C., that was about the biggest decision we've had, you know.
You didn't know
whether to go, and we talked about it and then decided not to.
Okay.
So, how would you like us?
Oh, I'm not going to touch that one. Okay, I'm trying to get the recorder in here, too. There. Okay. Wonderful.
Good.
Wonderful.
We're called the Research Center Archival Program.